Then I realized it was my own. I'd been clobbered on the head by a beer bottle. I felt no pain, but from this small flesh wound I bled like a slaughtered calf. No one around me seemed to have suffered any similar damage, so I lay back and made the most of it. My whites showed up the blood to some advantage, and I was soon surrounded by an admiring crowd. Now you've seen what he'd done. Hell, he looks bad, don't he? Reckon he's dying. Better call a doctor. There was anxious sympathy all round, and maybe I overdid it, for suddenly I was being given the kiss of life by a policeman. I broke free from this and fell into the soft, cotton-clothed arms of some young student nurses from Adelaide who held my wound closed with their long, scented fingers till the more proper bandages arrived. Getting blooded on the hill at Sydney Cricket Ground has always struck me as something of a rare privilege for a foreigner. It was a badge of both the passion and remorse of the cricket-watching fraternity of Sydney, and it later made me many friends in the bars of that city.
Sydney is obviously no place for a Gloucestershire supporter. Laurie Lee, reading from his own Hill Cricket in 1982. But we don't need to go to the Antipodes to find the truth. I'd guess that a genuine echo of all our holidays by the sea is to be found, if only we'd admit it, in Les Dawson's views, confided to David Jacobs.
Well, it's very nice. We've got a lovely view of the Groyne and just past the sewage reclamation works and the disused minefield. And we're staying at Bideawee, which is a lovely little guest house. It's a 2 up and 2 down and the drains are blocked. And it's very nice. It's only 3 minutes from the sea upwards.
Have you got all the family with you?
Yes, I've got the mother-in-law camp with her. She's in Vietnam on a goodwill tour in Hanoi. But the wife's here and the children.
What sort of holiday are you having there with the family?
Oh, it's very nice. There's dancing on the jetty till 8 o'clock. That's once a month. And then there's a cafe open till 8:30 where you can get cider and a bun. And we're having some Morris dancers from Lithuania on the lake tomorrow.
Right. Would you have any recollections, perhaps, of your very first holiday as a child?
Yes, I remember it very well, actually. I was stolen by gypsies. My father drove the caravan. I had an idea something was wrong, because when I got back, he'd rented me room off.
Are you a swimmer?
Yes, actually, apropos swim, my wife lost 2 stone swimming last week.
Yes,
I couldn't understand it, because I tied them around her neck tight enough.
Seaside, of course, is not the only place to be in summer. Some people's tastes veer more inland, to parks and gardens, terraces, gazebos and ha-has. And if that's where you want to go, then you need a reliable guide. Someone such as Vita Sackville-West, who not only writes books, but gardens herself, digs, weeds, and gets her hands dirty.
Have you ever seen Chant Mall near Kirtistock? Apart from its lovely name, the house and garden taken together are ideally combined. The house dates from 1612, and although the garden owes most of its beauty to its present owners, and to their extremely able gardener, the garden contrives to look as though it had been established there as long as the house itself. This was one of the places I really coveted. I should like to be the owner of Chant Mall. It seemed to me to include all the things that one likes best. A delicious house built of grey stone, wide views, terraced gardens, long walks through intelligently planted shrubberies, a semi-wild garden, where the natural streams were turned into winding ribbons of yellow and orange mimulus. Yes, Chant Mall was a place I coveted. It was so imaginative, so romantic. It wasn't too grand. It wasn't oppressive. It was a place in which one could have made one's home.
Yes. Victoria Sackville-West. Common as muck. Meanwhile, back in London, 1937... The summer night is gathering and the shadows are lengthening.
9 o'clock, and London a city of pleasure for those who've stayed in it. The city itself is deserted. The daytime workers are out on the road, on the courts, at home. But the West End is arrayed in bright, welcoming lights. And, of course, the proms in August. The floor of Queen's Hall packed, fountain and the unchanging goldfish, and the most enthusiastic musical audience in the world.
Summer Over England was presented by Nigel Ford and produced by Simon Elms. And since those proms back in 1937 in the Queen's Hall, that famously enthusiastic musical audience is now to be found all around me here in the Royal Albert Hall. I'm Andrew McGregor. You join us all live here on BBC Radio 3 for the second part of this evening's prom given by the BBC Symphony Orchestra and its principal guest conductor, David Robertson. And they're going to perform a single symphony, the Second Symphony by Jean Sibelius. It was finished early in 1902, and Sibelius scored a major success with it, conducting the first performance himself in Helsinki. So let's get the conductor's view of the Second Symphony from David Robertson.
It's both a very dramatic work in the sense that we feel it is telling an internal story, and yet at the same time he is working to get his symphonies ever closer to a classical ideal, in which everything is related motivically in the way that Beethoven or Haydn or Mozart would have thought about it. But one of the things he's taken from this notion of a narrative story is that life is about transformation. And so we see in the Second Symphony that he may do something in the exposition according to classic sonata form, but when the recapitulation comes back, he refuses to do the thing in exactly the same way, and he's making lots of subtle changes. So we can see that he's actually really pushing his idea, his own unique personal viewpoint of what the symphony is, forward. So it's beyond the sort of rhapsodic nature of the first. It's not yet at the classicism of the third, but there are very definite indications of this notion of one single movement which encompasses everything which he achieved with his final symphony, the seventh.
So that's the context for the Second Symphony, conductor David Robertson's view of how it fits into the canon. But what about the sound it makes?
The sound world is very much that of the Romantic orchestra, but not always with the choices that one would expect. So in certain moments, he will use instruments, for example, like the bassoon, to do things that are really rather heroic and that you wouldn't expect the bassoons to do, the beginning of the second movement. Other places in which the brass, instead of being there for their heaviness and their loud qualities, are actually there to give a sort of sense of space with these very soft chords that, unless you're really paying attention, you won't even find audible. And yet if they weren't there, suddenly the music would sound somehow less expansive. These are devices that he's more or less inventing with this symphony. And this is very radical. This is the sort of thing that's going on with the sound world. He's exploring this almost inner sound of the orchestra rather than just the question of how best to make the melody sound luscious.
And luscious it certainly can sound with its broad melodies and rich orchestration, and for all its typically Sibelian shadows. The second is ultimately one of his most radiant symphonies. Well, we just heard the voice of David Robertson, the principal guest conductor of the BBC Symphony Orchestra, and here he comes to conduct the Symphony No. 2 in D major by Jean Sibelius.
Thank you.
A work hailed after its first performance in Helsinki in 1902 as a definitive masterpiece. One of the few symphonic creations of our time that points in the same direction as Beethoven's symphonies. The Symphony No. 2 in D major, Opus 43, by the Finnish composer Jean Sibelius, performed here at this evening's BBC Prom in the Royal Albert Hall by the BBC Symphony Orchestra, led by Stephen Bryant, and conducted by its Californian principal guest conductor, David Robertson, who's just come back onto the stage, staying at the back of the platform, making sure that the timpanist and the full complement of brass players on the back row get their much-deserved ovation from the promenaders. Now it's the turn of the winds of the BBC Symphony Orchestra. And finally, the full complement of strings rises to share in the acclaim as well. But it's not the last Sibelius at this season's proms. His evergreen Corellia Suite is on the programme a week tomorrow, Sunday the 5th, which is Henry Wood Day at the proms, an all-day celebration of the proms' founder and conductor, recreating The Last Night from a century ago, 1910. And then the evening concert of music premiered by or closely associated with Henry Wood, played by the Ulster Orchestra, and including that Corellia Suite by Sibelius. Back comes David Robertson. And this orchestra's work at the proms is far from over. They're back a week on Wednesday with chief conductor Jerzy Bielochlawek. And, of course, there's one final premiere ahead of it this season. Jonathan Dove's A Song of Joys, which opens the last night of the proms on Saturday the 11th, all live here on BBC Radio 3. And they're off to the Edinburgh Festival as well. Well, tomorrow sees another great Bruckner Symphony, number 4, The Romantic, from the Minnesota Orchestra and Finnish music director and celebrated Sibelian Osmo Vanska. So this time, the Finnish conductor gets Barber. He's conducting Barber in tomorrow night's prom. It's the American who gets Sibelius. And here at the Royal Albert Hall, we're all hammered out, thanks to Mark Antony Turnage's world premiere earlier, to keep us buzzing while we wait for Jamie Cullum to take to this famous stage in the late prom. Back in Broadcasting House, here's Ian Skelly.
Andrew, thank you very much indeed. Andrew McGregor at the Royal Albert Hall for the first of our two live proms tonight. As he says, we're back there for something a little different at 10:15. Don't forget that you can hear tonight's first prom, again, if you missed some of it, on Wednesday the 8th of September. That's in the afternoon on Radio 3 from 2 o'clock. Tomorrow, by the way, it's the prom from last Thursday, which was given by the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra under Martin Brabbins. They gave the first UK performance of a new piece by James Dillon. That was alongside music by Mozart, Rimsky-Korsakov, and to end, Tchaikovsky, his second symphony. That's all from 2:20 tomorrow afternoon here on BBC Radio 3. And there are plenty of proms-related features when you wake up to the world via Radio 3.
On Breakfast, each morning through the summer proms season, we'll be bringing you the Henry Wood Proms Novelties, pieces of music that Sir Henry Wood introduced to proms audiences for the very first time, going right the way back to the first season in 1895. There are lost gems and works that have become great classics over time. The Henry Wood Novelties, in Breakfast on Radio 3, every morning from 7.
And you can learn a great deal about the proms on the Radio 3 website as well, bbc.co.uk/radio3. Via that, you can go to the BBC iPlayer and hear tonight's proms anytime you'd like to. And it's also where you can offer your own review of tonight's performance by clicking on the button marked Share at the BBC Proms website. So it's worth taking a look at both of those sites. A wealth of fascinating material. You could say it's what the internet was invented for. Well, as Andrew was saying, we return to the Royal Albert Hall for that late-night prom with Jamie Cullum. Before then, we're going to turn our attention to another popular hall in times gone by, the Victorian Music Hall. Billy Bragg investigates what it was really like to work in them, and for that matter, to be a member of the audience. He even gives a performance himself in one of them in the Hoxton Hall. The Good Old Days, presented by Billy Bragg, is at 9:15 tonight on Radio 3. And to take us there, the music of Maurice Ravel, a piano transcription of his Memorial to a Lost World. He composed La Valse in the wake of the First World War, and he used the waltz as his means of describing a shattered culture that lay in ruins in the aftermath of the conflict. The waltz builds to a confidence, but slowly the decadence sets in. The dance becomes ever more desperate, ever more destructive. This is the piano transcription for two pianos, and the two pianists here are Sergio Tiempo and Karin Lechner, that make up the duo Lechner-Tiempo. The duo Lechner Tiempo playing the transcription for two pianos of Ravel's La Valse. Well, in an hour from now on Radio 3, we're going to be crossing live once again to the Royal Albert Hall for a late-night prom given by Jamie Cullen and the Heritage Orchestra teaming up together to provide music that fuses rock and electronica and no doubt a great deal of Jamie's own style of jazz. Well, to get us in the mood for that at 10:15, here's a bit of jazz fusion from an earlier generation created by the magic of Yehudi Menuhin and Stefan Grappelli. Unique combination, Yehudi Menuhin and Stefan Grappelli playing Crazy Rhythm from T for Two. And don't forget, Jamie Cullen is live here on BBC Radio 3 in just under an hour from now, live from the Royal Albert Hall in a late night prom. But now on Radio 3, Billy Bragg explores the world of Victorian Music Hall, where he reveals that it was in fact Britain's first pop music, an urban folk culture in which raucous song vied with cutthroat commercialism. It's easy to feel nostalgic about Music Hall, but was it really the good old days?
Started an ordinary and I thought I'd die. When pointing to me, watch a chain, he yelled to me, hey!
You look dapper from your napper to your bleed. Dressed in style with a brand new dial. Father's old green Zion. I wouldn't give you dubbers for your old watch chain. Oh, Zion, oh, Zion.
Like many people, I learnt the old Music Hall songs from my family, standing around the piano at Christmas, all singing along as my nan bashed out the tunes on an old upright. As far as I'm concerned, these are Britain's urban folk songs. Lowbrow or highbrow, whether you like it or not, you'll probably know the chorus.
In the old iron,
All the songs, all, nearly all of them, seemed so familiar.
My nan used to sing The Boy I Love Is Up in the Gallery, and, you know, My Old Man So Follow the Van. It's a shame that a lot of people don't know that it was Marie Lloyd that sung these songs. When you sing them, you say, oh, I didn't know that Marie Lloyd sung those.
Paid a shilling to go up into the gods, and we were laughing before he came on because we knew what he was going to sing, and it was the same old thing, but it was so funny. Because we're talking about 80 years ago when I first went to the music hall, and it's difficult to say who was top of the bill, who was bottom of the bill. Harry Champion, he used to sing Any Old Iron.
My father, who was born in 1915 and grew up in Stepney, he sang round the house all the time, and he sang the music hall songs, the well-known ones. I mean, I just grew up knowing them all so well.
Even today at football grounds, there are chants to the tunes of things like I Do Like to Be Beside the Seaside. They have retained their kind of patina, as a kind of sediment in the mind, and the tunes bubble up.
Numinous in evanescence, non pareil nenuphar of nubility.
But the way we look at musical has been obscured by nostalgia. It's been cleaned up and sugar-coated. It's become like steam trains or trams, the preserve of backward-looking enthusiasts. I want to reclaim Music Hall from its Victorian dust and find out what it was really about. I'm in Abney Park Cemetery in North London, which is a big old Victorian necropolis that was founded for the burial of non-conformists. And as soon as you walk in the back gates there, is the grave of William Booth, the founder and first general of the Salvation Army. But we're here to find the grave of a different kind of nonconformist down this gravelly path. Abney Park Cemetery is the resting place of a number of music hall greats.
At last, another living being. Hi, Neil, I'm Billy Craig.
Neil Morcunis of the Music Hall Guild of Britain and America is showing me their graves.
So do you scour graveyards for these people?
We do indeed.
Into the undergrowth, then.
That's right. Watch your step. Mm-hmm. So we're going to see the grave of your original Champagne Charlie.
Right. George Leybourne, who died September 15th, 1884, aged 42 years.
Champagne Charlie is my name.
George Leybourne was part of the early group of musical performers who were stars in the 1860s and 1870s. I'll drink every drop there is. He made a huge name for himself and probably lived too much of the Champagne Charlie lifestyle, dying at 42.
Well, if you a lot of champagne, a lot of Charlie will do that to you.
Champagne Charlie is my name.
Leybourne originally came from Newcastle and first appeared at the Whitechapel Music Hall in 1864. He was the pioneer of a new type of comic character who would embody the hedonistic and irreverent spirit of music hall. In pictures and cartoon sketches, he often wears a top hat and tails and waves a bottle of vintage Moët and Chandon champagne around. But at the heart of his performance was a Mickey take on the Toffs. His fellow singer Vance responded with a song called Clico, and their rivalry was a big hit with the public.
Most of the popular music hall artists adopted a persona, which was represented by costume and by stance and by gesture.
Geoffrey Richards is Professor of Cultural History at Lancaster University.
One of the most popular characters was the Lion Comique, of whom the great exponent was George Leybourne, Champagne Charlie. This was a caricature dandy, or swell, partly aping the upper classes, but also celebrating hedonism. The whole duel they had, this musical duel they had, songs about drink. After Champagne Charlie came out, Vance had one on Burgundy, and then Charlie had one on something else, and so on and so forth. They were battle backwards and forwards, songs about drink. And that was a character which was partly a send-up, but partly an affirmation of a kind of hedonistic lifestyle.
Resting with George is his son-in-law, the great Albert Chevalier. They actually share a grave. Chevalier was born in London's Notting Hill and epitomised the way music hall would become respectable and middle class by the end of the 19th century.
What's very interesting about Albert Chevalier is that he came from a legitimate theatre background.
I got a pen,
He was known as the Costa's Laureate. He would do lots of Costa monologues, and probably his most famous song is My Old Dutch.
And Acosta being a costermonger.
That's right.
Someone who sold fruit and veg
that
they grew themselves on the street.
That's correct.
I'm also hoping to meet Fenton Gray, whose ancestor, who trod the boards, is buried in here. Fenton, there you are, mate.
Hello, Billy. Very nice to meet you.
Hi. Nice to meet you.
Well, here I am at the grave of my great-grandfather, Dan Crawley, who's just there, that beautiful-looking angel.
What was his act? What was the centre of his act?
Well, he was a sort of eccentric comedian, always songs. Obviously, he must have done patter as well. And he gradually incorporated drag into his music hall act. And his wife, Lillian, was a male impersonator, so she wore the trousers and he wore the dress.
That must have been interesting at the, dinner table, of an evening.
He was likened to Dan Leno, and at the beginning of his career, he used to impersonate Dan Leno.
Like Dan Leno, Fenton Gray is one of Britain's leading character actors and comic singers.
Now, I'm not what people call a flirt.
So I understand that you started incorporating some of your great-grandfather's songs into your act today.
Yeah, quite often I do cabaret performances, and it seemed like a good opportunity to try a couple of his numbers out and just see how they went down.
As part of this programme, I'm going to get the opportunity to come and sing some songs with you at one of your gigs.
Absolutely, I'm looking forward to it. We're doing a gig at Hoxton Hall, also steeped in history.
The prospect of performing at Hoxton Hall is giving me a few nerves.
It's quite loud piano.
No, he does play with my nan, actually. My nan used to bang it. It's pretty good. I like it. I gave a helping.
Although I grew up with these songs, I've never actually performed them in public while sober before. So a bit of rehearsal is in order with pianist Charles Miller.
With a 2 hour and a chat. I wonder what that is. Cos it's little things like that, what does you good?
Classic histories of the genre, like Harold Scott's The Early Doors, claimed that music hall was invented by one or two impresarios in London. In fact, it grew organically out of working-class pub culture. The first histories of music hall were written by middle-class journalists or literary types.
The authors of the early music hall books were journalists.
Dagmar Kift is a curator at the Westphalian Industrial Museum in Dortmund, Germany.
They aspired to work in London, visited the London music halls, and described the glamour and the good old times they had in those halls. They certainly weren't interested in going into dull working class cities of the north and looking into the cultural scene there.
A dazzling blaze of gas, the sharp clink of pewter pots and glasses, an incessant babble of voices, male and female, talking, shouting and laughing, an insignificant-looking creature standing in the centre of a large stage and lustily stretching his lungs in the somewhat vain endeavour to make himself audible above the general clamour. Such is the appearance presented by the interior of a music hall.
Reports like this from the Dublin University Gazette tend to put a rosy glow on music hall. Frustrated by the anecdotal nature of the existing literature, Dagmar Kift turned to local newspaper reports in Britain to put music hall into its social context.
So I wondered whether reports of fires or other catastrophes might not shed some light. The lists of the casualties indicate that the audiences in the music halls in the northern industrial cities were working class, lower middle class, male and female, and to a high percentage young people from the age of 13, 14, 15, 16, 17 were people who were already working in factories, who had finished school, and they claimed the same right to have being entertained as everybody else.
It's not so different from today, really. The urban young letting off steam. Music hall attracted the kind of audience who today will be going clubbing.
Grace's Alley, yeah.
But to get a real picture of what these early music halls felt like, I set out to look round one of these places. They're surprisingly hard to find.
I'm standing in an alley just off of Cable Street in East London, Grace's Alley, and as you can hear, just over the wall is a school. The kids are out in the playground. And in front of me is the facade of Wilton's Music Hall,
one of the original music halls and the last of its kind still preserved here in the East End. And I'm with Jackie Bratton and John Earle. So let's go inside and have a look at this wonderful building.
Well, here we are in a narrow hallway. This gives you no idea of what you're going to see. You see this mysterious staircase going up in front of you, apparently leading nowhere, and dark passages on either side.
So we're following through this passageway, John, into this beautiful, beautiful hall.
And as you can see, it's hugely bigger than the pub it stands behind.
It's massive.
Any old iron. Oh, the acoustics are just great, aren't they? That is really incredible.
The interesting thing about the high roof is that there's been recently an acoustic test on it, which shows that the acoustics, if the stage is in use, are virtually the same as the Wigmore Hall.
Any old iron, any old iron.
The first halls grew very organically out of the rooms of the pub. So the bar let you through into a singing room. And as those singing rooms were pulled down and built ever bigger and bigger, they were built on the pattern of the public hall of the time, an oblong, shoebox-shaped room.
Jackie Bratton is Professor of Theatre and Cultural History at the University of London.
On the floor of the hall, there would be tables in the front third or so, with groups gathered round them. And behind that, there would be rows of benches with backs, and on the backs of the benches there would be a ledge for the people behind to park their drinks on. And all round the sides there was lots of circulation room.
Wilton's was part of an extraordinary boom in music hall building in the 1860s. Hundreds of many different sizes were built around London. There was the Canterbury in Lambeth, for example, the Oxford on Oxford Street, and Collins Music Hall in Islington. But very few of these buildings survive in their original form.
In the whole country, we only have really two other substantial survivors of the period. One is in Glasgow, the Britannia. One is in Leeds, the City Varieties. The rarity of physical remains from that period can't be overemphasised. Music halls, even partly altered music halls of that period, are now much rarer than Saxon churches.
The expansion of pubs into music halls was a consequence of the Industrial Revolution. And at the heart of that revolution was London, the trading hub of the empire.
I keep the pub, the Rose and Crown, I should say, it keeps me.
In the first half of the 19th century, there was a huge influx of people into the capital.
Hundreds of thousands of people are suddenly arriving and they need something to do, somewhere to go. You get amateur singing to start with, you get free and easy nights, club nights. And then by the 40s, this has become obviously a nice little earner. And the publicans think, I can get bigger and bigger audiences in here because there are more and more people around. And they start to employ professionals. They get a chairman, they get a pianist, and the once or twice a week club night turns into every night entertainment.
On we blow, then the botman cried, the blooming bat's on fire. On fire, says Brown.
With only one exit through the pub at the front, Wilton's would have been a virtual death trap in the event of a fire, of which there were many in the old music halls. This prompted an Act of Parliament, passed in 1878, that required the halls to be made safe. Health and safety ultimately did for places like this, but there were other people, weren't there, who were concerned with the moral health and safety of the audience.
This was thought of as a sort of outreach arm of the drinks industry, really. People were lured in here, was the fear, and various kinds of immorality, starting with drink but going to other places, would take place. And this probably wasn't the case, and you also found apologists saying, on the contrary, the music hall is a force for the good because the working man brings his wife with him when he comes to these places. He will get less drunk. The whole thing is a social activity that is a good idea.
But it wasn't just the drink. What really disturbed the upper classes was the double life that the music hall created. The boundaries of what was respectable in Victorian Britain were slowly being broken down. Geoffrey Richards.
The atmosphere was extremely relaxed and free and easy. The traditional audience was very distinctive. Young, wage-earning adults, both working class and lower middle class. Men and women, people who went for a good night out. Which is why it tended to be in its early days, more raucous, more anti-authoritarian. That is the kind of attitude, the irreverent attitude of young people under 25. There were middle-class people in the audience too, but they were also tended to be young wage earners. They were clerks and they were shop assistants, the people who were in the new retail industries, who may have emerged from the working class but were becoming middle class.
As was the case with George Leybourne, now resting in Abney Park Cemetery, the musical songs were performed theatrically. The singers parodied the characters that they saw around them on the streets.
In the early days, when people first began to dress and sing in character, it was partially out of a fascination with the new urban landscape around them, that there were people who were costermongers, there were people who were chimney sweeps, there were the gas man. All kinds of new types had suddenly appeared in the urban landscape, and it was almost a way of situating the audience within this much more varied array of human activity than had been available to you in previous generations.
But while the characters reflected life on the streets, the subject matter of the songs reflected life on the inside, everyday domestic concerns and matters of the heart, and other regions of the body.
Music hall songs tended to be about love, which was treated romantically and sentimentally. So you had songs like The Boy I Love Is Up in the Gallery and I'll Be Your Sweetheart. Marriage, which tended to be regarded as a trap, and henpecking wife was a theme of songs. A very famous one is Gus Elan's It's a Great Big Shame. It's a great big shame, and if she belonged to me,
I'd let her know who's who. A nagging at a fella what is 6 foot three, and her only 4 foot two. Hadn't been married not a month nor more, when underneath her thumb goes Jim. How isn't it a pity as the likes of her should pat upon the likes of him?
And then there's the subject of sex, which was treated always with innuendo. The great exponent of this was Mary Lloyd, and her songs are full of suggestive lines, which the audience knew what they were about, even if they were ostensibly about something else. So, for instance, she would come on with a parasol and sing, I haven't had it up for a week. Or she would sing about a woman travelling on the train, she's never had her ticket punched before. And then one of her favourite songs, A Little of What You Fancy Does You Good, one line is, suppose it makes you fat, I don't worry over that. Well, the fatness is becoming pregnant.
Now I always, always having it, if you fancy it. If you fancy it, that's understood. And suppose it makes you fat, I don't worry over that. Cause a little of what you fancy does you good.
Because of her reputation for innuendo, she was banned from the first ever Royal Variety performance in 1912. This was when the musicals were becoming respectable, but she never became respectable. She remained always a kind of raucous, earthy voice of the people.
Since Mother Eve in the garden long ago started a fashion, fashion's been a passion. Eve wore a costume we might describe as brief.
Actress Jessie Wallace brought Mary Lloyd to life brilliantly in a recent BBC television drama based on the singer's life. Mary Lloyd's trademark gesture was the knowing wink. It was key to the richly ironic sauciness that Jessie brought to the screen.
I had to get the movements right, you know, the little wink of the eye and the movement of her bum and all that sort of tongue-in-cheek stuff.
See the girls in the prehistoric days.
She wore mini skirts and low cut tops. For Victorian times, that was really risky.
Wearing just a row of beads and not much more. Fancy me.
She was very outspoken. She always said what she thought. She always sort of stuck her two fingers up to the system. That's what was great about her.
When I take my morning promenade, quite a fashion card on the promenade. Now I don't mind nice boys staring hard if it satisfies their desire.
When I did the, and I don't mind nice boys staring hard, when I got to that bit, I had her parasol and I lifted it up in a rude gesture, but they'd done a close shot of that, so they didn't get that in because I think I went a bit too far there.
This is Vesta Tilly singing Jolly Good Luck to the Girl Who Loves a Soldier, which she sang impersonating a young man.
Jolly very good luck to the girls who love the soldiers.
The musical singers treated conventional categories of gender and class with a subversive irony.
Oh, no, we military men always do our duty everywhere.
It's sometimes hard for us today to work out exactly what was going on, especially when they started cross-dressing.
There were male and female impersonators. And this is very interesting because you had women like Vesta Tilly and later Hetty King playing soldiers and playing dandies and almost parodying them. And then you had male performers like Dan Leno, for instance, who would dress up as a kind of harridan, as a fearsome landlady or stepmother figure.
I'm a young girl of 18. I used to be Mother Goose. And now I am what I was before I was what I am now.
And I did promise at my last gig that I would put a dress on, and I'm going to put a dress on tonight. Yay! Yay! First time in my life I hesitated.
But this had the effect of actually endorsing gender images, because by slightly sending them up and then going back to normal afterwards, you actually endorse the roles that people apparently have in society.
Ever since there have been actresses on the stage, there have been actresses cross-dressing as boys, because there is a perennial attraction in being able to see a woman's legs on the stage. But I think that the act of male impersonation on the music halls is something slightly different to that.
There's a good time coming for the ladies, the good time coming by and by.
Vesta Tilly prided herself on the perfection of her imitation of masculinity. With every singer, it wasn't equally loving. There are stories about male impersonators singing very scornful anti-male songs.
I'm ready to run the pantomime.
How did you get those trousers on, and did they hurt you much? And the young swells in the first rows of the audience getting very incensed about this picture of themselves. But what that singer, it's Nellie Power in this instance, is doing is singing over their heads to the working class men behind, who didn't wear that kind of clothes and who thought that these visitors from the West End were pretty effete and despicable. So Nellie Power is projecting two different messages to different parts of the house. And she's said to have had to dodge soda siphons thrown from the stalls when she got particularly outrageous.
There's a wonderful painting in the Museum of London called Popularity, which depicts hundreds of musical stars.
But the great thing about this picture is almost everybody who's in the picture is defined by the hat they're wearing.
Yeah, it's true.
Obviously some Victorian men here are still wearing sort of bowlers and Victorian and top hats there. Then they're the kind of proto-Edwardians wearing the straw boaters. Mm. But most interesting of all, there's this small corner where there's just a couple of white actors in black face. Now, clearly, the minstrelsy did play a role in music hall.
Yeah.
What was the context of bringing white men in black face into this? Because we're in a situation where almost everyone was in some kind of transgressive costume. Working class people were dressed as toffs. Middle class people like Albert Chevalier were dressed as costers. Men were dressed as women. Women were dressed as men. And into this mix, you throw people in blackface. What was the context of their appearance?
A great many people start in blackface, and I think if you go on with what you think is going to be an act and you fail, they aren't going to know you next time.
Jackie Bratton.
If you were in blackface, you change your name, wash it off, you become an Irish comedian, and you're somebody new, you can try again. Also, it's got all kinds of resonances that strike deep into what you might call English folk culture. Mm. Blacking your face in order to go out and break the looms.
Yep.
Blacking your face in order to perform a dance in the streets as some sort of clog dancer or Morris man.
She ain't no pickaninny from way down the West Virginia, but she sets a dream and wears the salmon water flow.
So the blackface in some ways was more of a licence to do something a bit different.
Yes.
Rather than a racial...
Yeah. It was licensed for a kind of grotesque clowning. And you, on many, many, many music hall bills, you find a pair of funny blacks.
Yeah.
That's what it says on the billing, funny blacks.
You can get a feel for the theatricality and style of these performers from contemporary paintings. But as a singer-songwriter myself, I want to find out how these character songs are put together and what actually makes music hall songs distinctive.
And where better than in the venue where I'm going to be performing music hall songs myself?
I'm in Hoxton Hall in East London, which is a surviving example of the early music hall built in the 1860s. And I'm meeting with Derek Scott, who's Professor of Music at Leeds University. Derek, you're leaning up against the fabulous old upright piano there. Perhaps you could sit at it and talk a little bit about some of the character songs that were in the music hall.
We're in a hall built in the 1860s. There are about 25,000 Jews living in the East End at this sort of time. There will be a Jewish influence on music hall song. Here's an example of a Jewish song. Oi, oi, what a game it is, oi, oi. You'd add something to the accompaniment that suggested something a little bit culturally different. So this song, the verse pattern is...
So what was the response of the highbrow musical establishment to the arrival of music hall in the Victorian period?
Well, they hated the musical style as much as they hated the words, really, and as much as they hated some of the accents in which it was sung. The composer, Hubert Parry, thought that the musical style was as horrible as the sound of Cockney speech itself. If I give a couple of examples from If It Wasn't for the Houses in Between, the Gus Eilen song, the opening of it begins with this figure. Parry would have hated that, because what should happen in classical practice is this. This note, it doesn't really fit the chord. It sounds fine, but it breaks the classical rules. In the 18th century, Mozart could be popular, it was still serious music because the style was just the same. What happens with the music hall is you have a style that is not the same style as classical music.
As I was preparing to come on the stage, the manager whispered to me.
The music hall establishes the verse plus chorus song. Usually you'll have a not particularly melodious verse. It will contain the narrative, probably fairly declamatory. Then you'll move on to a really tuneful chorus.
So you must cut your chorus right now. So don't sing the chorus, I beg of you.
So this is the beginning of the pop song as we know it. The hook that's so important to 20th century pop music is invented, really, in the music halls.
That's more or less it. If you look at the structure of a music hall song, you'll find that it's got the intro, it's got the verse, it's got the chorus, it's got sometimes a little outro as well. All that's missing is the bridge section that you'll often get in a modern pop song.
And this is really interesting if you think about Britain's early pop stars. Tommy Steele and Joe Brown's first hits were written by the composer of music halls and East End Jew, Lionel Bart. There's a lovely story Joe Brown tells of his first encounter with Lionel.
Lionel takes one look at me and says, "What a lovely boy you've got, boy. I should have a boy like lovely Jewish accent and the whole bit, you know. My boy," he said, "I've got a hit song for you." I said, "What's that?" And he starts waving this piece of paper at me. He said, "This is the music." I look at the music and it's a bit of paper. It's all covered with numbers, right? So I said, "What kind of music is that?" He said, "Hang on a minute." And he threw the lid of the piano up and on the keyboard he had all numbers. And he went, 139, 139, 179, 5456. I said, "What's that?" He said, "That's the music." I said to him, "What about the lyrics?" He said, "Don't worry about the lyrics. You wait until you hear the words." He said, so, "What's it about?" He said, "It's called Jelly Deals." I said, "Well, how does it go?" He said, "I'll show you." And he opened the piano and he says, goes like this. He goes, "Jelly deals, jelly deals, wobbling about like wonky wheels." I said, "This is magic."
Now, ever since I was a mite, I've had a whacking appetite. My hollering for dinner would raise the rafters.
He says, "A hit song." I said, "Mr. Bart," I said, "I don't want to do that sort of stuff. I want a rock and roll guitar player, you know." "No, you do it, son, it'll be all right." Anyway, because I had to do it. Sure enough, it was a hit.
When something's popular, it's not long before the upper classes want to get in on the action. In 1889, the young intellectual and writer Rudyard Kipling, recently arrived home from India, moved into lodgings in central London. I love this account he wrote in his autobiography of his local music hall in Charing Cross. From my desk, I could look out of my window through the fanlight of Gatti's music hall entrance across the street, almost onto its stage. 4 pence, which included a pewter of beer or porter, was the price of admission to Gatti's. The smoke, the roar, and the good fellowship of relaxed humanity at Gatti's set the scheme for a certain sort of song. The private soldier in India I thought I knew fairly well. His English brother, in the guards mostly, sat and sang at my elbow any night I chose. The outcome was the first of some verses called Barrack Room Ballads.
That description of the fact is there's another fellow looks like me. Yes, another fellow looks like me.
Kipling saw himself as a poet, almost in the way that a modern songwriter would see himself, rather than a modern poet.
Jackie Bratton.
He's interested in the memorableness of song. And that's one of the things he talks about with music hall song, that people would walk out of the doors still singing it, still singing the chorus. So he likes the fact that there's a repeatable chorus and that there are lots of repetitions within every verse and that it tells a very simple story, but as forcefully and memorably as possible. And so when he comes to write the Barrack Room Ballads, that's the sort of pattern he works on. And this is a stanza from Tommy, which is about his admiration for the common soldier and the fact that most people in England treated the common soldier rather badly.
I went into a theatre as sober as could be. They gave a drunk civilian room but hadn't none for me. They sent me to a gallery or ran the music halls, but when it comes to fighting, Lord, they shoved me in the stalls.
Like the Moulin Rouge in Paris, the colourful, brash world of the music hall was a source of inspiration for writers, poets and visual artists. Many were attracted to its raucous rebellion against polite restraint. Another notable visitor to Gatti's was one of the boldest painters of late Victorian Britain, Walter Sickert.
Sickert was attracted to the idea of painting the halls, partly because it had never been done before, and partly because it drew on a tradition that he'd been introduced to by his great hero, Degas.
Matthew Sturgis, biographer of Walter Sickert.
Degas, of course, had painted ballet girls and the singers in Café Chantants, but the musical was something uniquely British. He was fascinated by low tones, the effects that colours would make in low light. The musical was an extraordinary playground for such effects. He would make dozens and dozens of sketches, working always in the dark, so he wasn't able to see really what he was drawing. There was an outcry against what one critic described as the essential vulgarity of Sickert's subject matter. And of course, Sickert was absolutely delighted by this reaction. He certainly did want to shock his audience. It was the novelty of the subject matter, the idea that the modern city was a fit subject for artistic investigation, which was one of the lessons he'd learnt from Degas and the Impressionists, that he wanted to transfer and introduce into the polite world of British art.
But even as the aesthetes were discovering music hall in all its lurid colour and untrammelled hedonism, the true spirit of the halls was being threatened by the dynamics of big business. Geoffrey Richards.
The music halls began to change dramatically in the 1880s and 1890s. They became the prototype commercialised entertainment industry. They were so successful that tycoons and impresarios began to pump capital into them, to buy up individual music halls, to build new music halls, to establish chains. There was the Moss Empire, there was Stoll Chain, the Thorntons. Because of the railways, they were able to transport their performers around the country and have music halls that were circuits. Because they already had the working class audience, they made a concerted bid to get a middle class audience into the music halls. They introduced self-censorship, banning various topics that might put off respectable people. Collins Music Hall, for instance, produced a series of bans. You could not make derogatory references to the royal family, to politicians, to the law, to religion, to London County Council. They then have a rule of banning anybody who looks shabby or unrespectable from coming in. But most of all, they change the layout of the music hall. You get fixed theatre seating. You get a proscenium arch. They get rid of the chairman. They put a number up for when the turn is coming up. And they ban food and drink from the auditorium.
So they cleaned up the music halls and created a new catch-all entertainment. Variety.
Let's have a song upon the gramophone that Billy Williams sings so grand with his sable.
As well as the commercial pressures, the development of mechanised media, the gramophone, eventually the radio, and the magic of film, brought rich new sounds and images from across the Atlantic and collectively dealt another blow to British music hall.
The gramophone and the wireless brought the music hall into your own home. You didn't have to go out to see it. And of course, what it did was to wipe out performers, because they had for years and years toured with one act or a few songs. And the gramophone and the wireless were voracious. They devoured all this material, and you had to have new routines all the time. And that really finished off some people.
Popular music changed. Ragtime and then jazz came across the Atlantic. And the kinds of songs that might be sung in a popular venue changed forever.
Rags, rags, my big sister Trixie. When she's in the rag shop, she fancies she's in Dixie. I've got a bit.
A seat in a cinema was very cheap compared with what had now become rather plush and expensive venues that were the music halls of the turn of the century. So all of these things fall together so that there's a change in taste, a change in attitudes, and it's striking that the music hall stars are ageing, that the young people have gone somewhere else, are doing something different.
For me, there's an uncanny parallel between the history of music hall in the 19th century and pop music in the late 20th century. Both had their origins in the 50s, hit their peak in the 60s and 70s, but then became increasingly commercialised as big business took over. By the turn of the century, both were being overtaken by new media, the gramophone on one hand and the internet on the other. And both were turning into something different. Variety in the case of music hall and the X factor in the case of pop.
Just love them and leave them alone. Don't linger, they'll get you.
In the 1920s and 30s, certain leading writers became alarmed at the decline of music hall, the loss of gaslight and grease paint. Hoping to save the tradition, they instead turned it into something conservative and nostalgic. It was becoming a stick with which to beat modernity.
What's interesting is that intellectuals began to take up the music hall as it began to fade, and they did so because they disliked the idea of this prepackaged media, like film, which seemed to be cut and dried, and to lack immediacy, and to lack the ability to relate to the audience. J.B. Priestley, when he did his famous English journey, he wrote disgustedly, when he went to Leicester, he said, there's nothing here but films, films, films. Where are the performers, where are the music hall performers who relate to their audience directly across the footlights? T.S. Eliot wrote a celebrated essay on Mary Lloyd, in which he said she expressed the soul of the people.
The working man who went to the music hall and saw Mary Lloyd and joined in the chorus was engaged in that collaboration of the audience with the artist which is necessary in all art. He will now go to the cinema. He will have lost some of his interest in life.
It's amazing to think of this extraordinarily fastidious figure being drawn to this raucous, bawdy woman.
I'm leaning on the lamp, maybe you think I look a tramp.
What is inherited from the music hall is performers who go on into wireless, film and gramophone records.
I'm not a crook, and if you think that's what I look.
Gracie Fields, George Formby and Will Hay, who were three of the top British stars of the 30s, they all came out of the music hall, they'd all established on the halls a rapport with their audience, and they projected characters, either working class or, in the case of Will Hay, middle class, that the audience could identify with or laugh at or understand. And the other thing that developed is the sitcom. Towards the end of the musical, you had little sketches.
Honestly, Terry, I haven't a single thing to wear.
Well, I'm broad-minded. You can sleep in the raw, if you like.
They're kind of prototype sitcoms because they're about the battle of the sexes and they're about the leading figure defying the landlord or the landlady or the policeman or something of that sort.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Mr. Fenton Gray.
It's the big night at Hoxton Hall in Shoreditch, East London, and seasoned music hall performer Fenton Gray is out on stage. I'm back here putting on my pearly suit. We've got a real mixed crowd out there tonight that almost reflects the story of music hall itself. There are some locals who must have seen the poster outside, and also some lovies who've made the trip across town from the West End.
Will you please welcome our lovely special guest, Mr. Billy Bragg!
Oi, oi, it sounds like I'm on.
As you've probably heard, those lovely people from Radio 3, known for its high-class music, taking this evening your opportunity to appear on Radio 3 alongside Shostakovich and Tchaikovsky and all those other people who are loved here in Hoxton Hall. So,
the audience tonight have all been given song sheets to encourage them to sing along. But as it turns out, they don't need them. Each one of us knows every word of the chorus. Why don't you sing along at home?
Oh, I do like to be beside the seaside. Oh, I do like to be beside the sea.
Noel Coward has a marvellous line in Private Lives, "Strange how potent cheap music is." And what I find extraordinary is the way in which music hall songs lingered in people's memory for years and years and years.
Geoffrey Richards.
I think it's amazing evidence of the potency of these songs and the way in which the songwriters were on a popular wavelength. They were writing words and tunes which they knew would resonate. The public made them popular, and they carried on, and they still carry on, and they still, even in the minds of people who never set foot in a music hall, they're still there.
Music hall was Britain's first real popular music, and long after the social conditions that created it have disappeared, it continues to have an unacknowledged influence on the pop culture of this country.
The folk music of the urban working class, that's what we're singing here tonight, ladies and gentlemen. That's why you don't need to look at the choruses, really, do you? You know all these things, don't you? Oh, no, you don't.
Who are you calling working class?
There's your Radio 3 listener, mate.
Speaking personally, I sometimes feel more of an affinity with Gus Elan than I do with Elvis Presley. And the songs are still there, always just below the surface, waiting for a few drinks and some good friends to liberate them from our collective memory. There's also something of the style, the Barrow Boy flash and the swell panache, that still survives from Britain's original urban folk music. Ladies and gentlemen, the show goes on.
Well, we were all singing along here. The Good Old Days was presented by Billy Bragg and produced by Adam Lively. And it was a Just Radio production for BBC Radio 3.
The Proms on BBC Radio 3. Now, anyone who doesn't know the world of Bruckner symphonies would do well to listen to the Minnesota Orchestra Proms when they can hear Bruckner's Fourth Symphony, The Romantic, one of his most approachable works and a wonderful symphony in itself. And that will be conducted by Osmo Venska. Also, Shostakovich's first cello concerto, a very dramatic piece, which will be played by Eliza Weilerstein. And Barber's music for a scene from Shelley, a typical example of Barber's wonderful way with orchestral writing. Join me, Rob Cowan, as the BBC Proms continue tomorrow at 7:30 here on Radio 3.
Well, they continue before then. We're back at the Royal Albert Hall in just over 10 minutes' time for a late-night prom tonight, and it promises to be a very exciting event. Jamie Cullum hosts his own late-night prom. He's teamed up with the Heritage Orchestra, who were responsible for realising the soundtrack to Blade Runner for a recent Massive Attack festival. And together with Jamie, they blend rock and electronica with jazz at the core. So that's at 10:15 this evening, live here on BBC Radio 3. And we travel there via Bohemia, music by the leader of the Mighty Handful, the group of Russian composers who set about establishing a nationalistic style in Russian music in the late 19th century, Balakirev. This is his portrait of Bohemia, played by the USSR Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Yevgeny Svetlanov. Three very different Czech wedding tunes form the basis of that piece, woven together into that tome poem by Balakirev in 1906. Yevgeny Svetlanov conducted that performance by the USSR Symphony Orchestra back in 1983. This is BBC Radio 3. The time now is 10:15, and time for our second prom of the...